This narrator advises that the listener digest the following as entertainment. The showrunners behind it are neither six-figure filmmakers nor professional critics. They are casually critical.
Special shout out to Troy L, a longtime friend of the show, for recommending Moneyball. Thank you so much for showing us this movie, Troy. I'm glad that we could review it, and I hope you enjoy. Hello, and welcome to Casually Critical, a podcast show starring two pals who love to talk about storytelling. I'm your host, James Newton.
And I'm Daniel Carpenter, your co-host. Today's episode is going to be a very special time, as James and I are going to have a ball and review our first ever sports movie on this show. Hopefully we hit a home run and it doesn't drive you too batty, but it's going to be really, really fun. So, James, let's touch base before we head into spoilers later on. Let's start out with non-spoilers first. What are your overall feelings on sports movies? How does Moneyball compare to those movies?
You know, I don't mind a good sports movie, Daniel. I live in Indiana, where basketball is in the blood of every red-blooded American that lives next to me and around me and drives by me yelling out the window. So I haven't seen Hoosiers, but I've heard that's a thing and a very important movie for me to watch as an Indiana liver. Resident, that is.
Yeah, liver. I was going to say, you're more than just your liver,
James. There are some really nostalgic roots for me in sports movies because my dad loves sports. We'd watch baseball all summer long, play baseball. I played soccer. I did track and field. So I appreciate a good sports movie from Cool Runnings, you know? That might be the only one I can think of right now. Cool Runnings to Chariots of Fire. That was the one I was going to say.
Yeah.
There's
Chariots
a full.
Chariots of Fire is a good one. Also Miracle, or I think Miracle on Ice. I can't remember which one, but that was a really good hockey movie.
I've never really seen any hockey movies. My dad wasn't into hockey. However, we did see Field of Dreams and The Rookie. Okay. And there was one other that starred Robert Redford. The Natural. Hmm. That's it.
Gotcha.
Yeah, lots of baseball stuff mostly. A little bit of football sprinkled in now and again.
Okay, so you have a healthy diet of baseball movies that are already in your repertoire.
Yes.
Moneyball is very different. I would describe this as kind of a Jocks Nolan film or the Thinking Man's sports movie. Moneyball doesn't really focus solely on sports, and yet it does. It's focused more on the analytics, the research that really helped revolutionize the way that they play the game, the way they think about the game. Given your understanding of sports movies and your understanding of film overall, how does this compare?
It hits different, for sure. It doesn't, I'll say right away, it doesn't end in the way that a typical sports movie ends. And it also doesn't begin in the way a typical sports movie begins. Usually we're rooting for an underdog who's from a middle-of-nowhere town, who's trying to slug it out with the big city team or something like that. Or, oh my gosh, grandma's ice cream shop is going to go out of business, so we need to start a sports league. And things get a little crazy.
Right. Or, oh, you know what? You may not be as cool or rich as all your other peers, but you've got your quirky family and neighbors that just want to help you out, and will help you out in a Mr. Miyagi kind of homemade solution that rivals the top major leaguers' training regimens and even does it better.
Or for one of my favorite sports movies, all the men are gone and fighting in World War II, and so the women have to pick up the bat and start playing baseball. There's a lot of interesting subtext in a league of their own. That's one that I would recommend to anybody who likes baseball. I would recommend that to anyone.
I remember I first watched this movie, and it was a really interesting concept. This idea of, traditionally speaking, they were looking for a lot more than just performance. It's also about character, and it's about, can I sell this person? And, you know, it has some very interesting parallels to our casual correspondence review, where we had a lot of questions talking about marketing and storytelling. And it seems as if the sports world had the same thing, where they were considering not just, okay, can this person hit, but also, do they look good? Do they not throw weird? Can we market them and plaster their face everywhere? And along comes this financial analysis, this Yale grad played by Jonah Hill, that kind of helps challenge Brad Pitt's character on, well, do they get on base? And more or less, that's all you really need to look for. And then put them where they're really good at. They don't need to be good at everything. They just need to be good at the one thing that they can do. So I know I'm oversimplifying all that, but it's not a typical sports movie, and yet it totally is. There's some tropes it falls into, and there's also some tropes that it falls just outside of as well. This is a very interesting sports movie.
Yeah, I think, like I said earlier, the beginning and ending are definitely atypical of a sports movie. Not the very ending. The ending is very typical of a sports movie, where instead of showing us what happens, we get a large block of text to read before the credits start to roll. And that is one of my gripes about this movie, which we'll dive into a little bit more in the spoiler review. But sure. However, just as a concept, just in general, I don't really love that. Even in movies that are based on a true story, which is what this is, it's actually about, you know, Billy Beane and Peter Brand remaking the Oakland A's in whatever era it is. I'm guessing it was like late 80s, early 90s. We got CRT TVs. We've got little hand radios and car radios. So I'm guessing that's
I think it's early 2000s.
Early 2000s? Okay.
Yeah. Came out in 2011.
Yeah.
Yeah. I could be totally wrong on that. I think 90s to early 2000s, it's a solid bet. It's one of those eras for sure.
The first time I saw this movie, I don't think I really appreciated it for all of the things that it was trying to say and for all of its wrinkles. I feel like I just sort of saw it and didn't think about it. So yeah. This time I have a lot to say about it and a lot of things to ponder, I suppose, about what this movie is trying to accomplish, because it's very clear what the protagonists are trying to accomplish. They believe that a person can be summarized by one singular number that was created by a man who theorized about Moneyball decades past.
Yeah.
And they don't want to judge people for how they look. And so we do get this ragtag team of people put together that are kind of messy. And we don't really get to dive too deep into that.
No.
Which is really unfortunate. It really stays up here. I'm pointing at my noggin. It stays up in the head for a lot of the movie, which is why I think a Jocks Nolan film or a cerebral sports movie is a really good way of putting it, as you said, Daniel.
Yeah. For a cerebral movie, I love me some Christopher Nolan. But when James and I saw Tenet in theaters together back in 2020, it really highlighted the strengths and weaknesses that Christopher Nolan has in his movies. And one of the things is Christopher Nolan at his worst, is he neglects character for concept. He will prioritize concept at the expense of characters that are relatable and that are human and that you can relate to. They're really just vessels. And I remember I saw Moneyball. When I saw it for the first time, I remember it really intrigued me from a conceptual level, this idea that, oh, this actually happened, and we started diving into sports in a different way. I didn't know that. I think it's a fascinating POV of perspective of baseball from the manager's perspective, from the coach's perspective. Usually the coach, who in this movie is played by Philip Seymour Hoffman, rest in peace, he's one of my favorite actors. Usually the coach is like the hero. Usually the coach is the one that's either the main character or the mentor figure. It's one of those two. The coach is always the big shot. Here, for better or worse, which we'll touch on later, the coach is kind of literally thrown to the sidelines. And we focus on the people behind the coach. We focus on the general manager and the owner and the assistant general manager. And they're trying to figure out how to defy tradition while still getting runs and still getting points on the board. And that part was fascinating to me. But like you were saying, James, as I saw this going in, knowing, okay, we're going to review this and talk about it, there were a lot of flaws that I noticed, which is a surprise to me because Aaron Sorkin is one of the writers, and he's very well known for his writing prowess. He wrote The Social Network and more recently The Trial of the Chicago Seven. So he's known for really good dialogue, quick wit. I didn't really see that in this movie. In fact, I felt some of the dialogue was lacking, and there were many story beats that I don't think were touched on. So if I was a betting man, and I don't know, I'm not speaking from research here, I would assume that perhaps Aaron Sorkin was brought on last minute as a consultant to help polish things up, or more likely he helped make the outline of the script and then the other writer kind of filled in the blanks with dialogue and characters and moments. I'm not sure about that, but it was disappointing for me because this is not a good example of what Aaron Sorkin can do. And as I've said already, it leaves a lot to be desired.
And again, the idea of the movie is explored and it's executed and there's a payoff and all of those things happen. And it's good. That portion is intriguing to me. And also, like you said, the unique perspective of not from the player, but from the manager perspective and from this statistician guy, this economics major from Yale. That stuff is really great, but it feels like if that's really what we wanted to go into, why didn't we drill deep into that? Instead, I feel like we got a flyby of a bunch of other stories within the story that never really came to a close, never really had a satisfying ending or payoff in any way. Sometimes the arcs of these characters were just the first beat. We didn't get second beat. We didn't get third beat. You know, there was no reinforcement of anything. There was no
payoff. And therefore, we didn't get a home run.
That's true.
This movie said, can I just get my characters on first beat?
Yeah.
They didn't ever ask, can we score home runs with our characters, metaphorically speaking?
Yeah. But there are some elements in here that are really cool. It feels like the sort of Western movie where the West is coming to an end. And there are a lot of old guardians of the West that are saying, this is the way things ought to be. Trains are ruining our towns. The production of, like, the industrialization of America is the ruin of everything. I feel like that's the plot of a lot of Western movies, and I'm starting to see it reflected in a lot of other movies. In this case, the end of the West is the end of the star player. The star player is dying, and now it comes down to this is a team game, and we need to sacrifice the ability to be a big star and make big swings and just get on base, because that's what wins games. And that's the most fascinating thing to me. And that war between the more heady, geeky sports analysis and the kind of just go with your gut sports magic kind of recruiter vibe that a lot of people in the Oakland A's during this movie kind of resemble. Sorry, they don't resemble it. They embody it. That conflict is really intriguing. It's the old fashioned way versus the new intellectual way.
Yeah.
I really like that aspect of it the most, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a scene with Billy Bean, his Brad Pitt's character, and he's talking to one of his scouts, one of his head scouts. Or no, it's his head scout. And the head scout pulls him aside and says, I don't like what you're doing. He comes from an interesting place because for him, it's about the morality of the situation. A lot of the characters, a lot of these oddballs that Billy Bean is picking are not the most morally intact people. And a lot of people tend to brush them aside because even though they perform extraordinarily well, they're not exactly potential star players. They're not people that they would want to advertise and encourage people to come watch if they're living these lifestyles. And Billy Bean is already fully bought in at this point to this analytical method and saying, doesn't really matter, just matters that he gets on base, which is really cold. And they didn't touch on that a lot, but that was one interaction that stood out to me of like, that is a good point. This idea of celebrity, I wish they had leaned more into that nuance, but it was, it's the convincing enough reason of like, yeah, this is why these traditionalists are staying traditional, because for them, it's not just about baseball. It's also about, you know, the people that they are plastering on the screens and on television and on the posters.
Who's going to be on the next General Mills cereal box?
Yeah. Breakfast of Champions. But who's the champion? I don't know.
Yeah, we don't know.
Is it Sir Drinks-a-Lot?
Is it Sir Crooked Arm? Is it Mr. 45-year-old dad of two?
Is it Robin Wright's random cameo appearance, pretty much?
Yeah, very bizarre. The last thing I will say about this movie, going alongside what you're saying about wishing that they could have explored more of that stardom, there is a bunch of morality that is in this movie, like you said, about the cold numbers.
Yeah.
And it makes me kind of dislike the main character. I sympathize with him, but I also don't like him very much because I understand he's been hurt by the industry in the past, but that doesn't mean that he should distance himself from players, and that doesn't mean that he should sum someone up to just a number. I kind of hoped that he would learn something.
Yeah.
To me, it seems like he never really learned anything other than in for a penny, in for a pound. I need to double down on this strat and see what becomes of that.
I have some things to say about the main character as well. I don't think this non-spoiler section is the place to do it, but I was the exact same way, James. There were things about him I rooted for, but I didn't like rooting for him a lot. I didn't enjoy getting to sit with him in the room all the time, even though sometimes I did. I don't know. There was some fundamental things about him that irked me, and I'll go more into that in a little bit. But overall, James, kind of wrapping this game up here, do we have a home run or do we have a strikeout? What's your rating for this movie?
I'm going to give Moneyball a 3.5 out of 5.
And I'm going to give it a 3 out of 5. Well, the game's getting a little tough. Bases are loaded. Now it's time to strike our way over into spoiler territory.
Want to join the conversation? Follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Casually Critical Podcast to get the inside scoop on future episodes. Feel free to message us on either platform to join in the casual correspondence or provide feedback on the show. Now it's time to dive into our spoiler review.
I'm going to just say the elephant in the room right out the gate. What the heck did Robin Wright do in this whole movie? What did her character do? Billy Bean's ex-wife, maybe? She shows up in one scene. I was like, is that? And then I went on IMDb. I'm like, it is. Okay. And then she's in that scene. She has a phone call with Billy Bean at the end. That's it. I don't know her function of the story. I'm not even sure I know his daughter's function in the story. Maybe it's for the, you know, 30 to 50 year old people that saw this movie was probably catered for, that said, oh yes, a daughter, I can relate. Oh, he has an ex-wife. He's not a squeaky clean guy. I can relate to that.
I'm going to tell you exactly why the daughter exists in this movie. I think she serves a very good function.
Okay.
I didn't care about the success of the Oakland A's until I learned that he had a daughter who was worried about him and his success. Someone that he could talk to about his heart or lack thereof. You know, he could put up walls to show just how much he's hurting inside. That's the heart of the movie, is his daughter, his relationship with her, not wanting to let her down, wanting to provide for her, all those things. Like, is he willing to bet the farm on this new strategy if it means that his daughter isn't going to have tuition money? It seems it's not the sturdiest foundation because it's introduced quite late into the movie. And also because she has parents who appear to have a very nice home and appear to be very well off. So How much of that really matters, I don't know, but that's what grabbed me. Yeah. I was grabbed by the concept, and then I was like, who cares? And then I was hooked in by, oh, but also there's some skin in the game here. He has a daughter. He's not just a pitiful, sad, lonely man. I mean, he is, but he has this daughter that he cares about and wants to care for.
That's fair. That's fair. I think I was more distracted by her fire EP that she drops in the movie. I think that's a bop for sure. It slapped. I was jamming out at the very end there. Joking aside, though, I see your point. I really wish she had been introduced earlier in the movie, and that leads me to my biggest gripe, which is there is an abundance of technical laziness and storytelling laziness in this film.
Tell me about the technical laziness, Daniel. I didn't catch much of this.
Let me bust out my filmmaker hat. I mean, I've always worn it, but let me add another hat to it. So now I have double hat, filmmaker hat, Daniel. I'm double Dan. I'm super
double Dan defense.
Shout out to our Kung Fu Panda 3 review, which just dropped as of this recording.
Yeah.
So the cinematography is incredibly paint by numbers. Oh, we're having a conversation. Shot, reverse shot. Shot, reverse shot. Over the shoulder shot. Another over the shoulder shot. He leaves. He has another conversation. Shot, reverse shot, shot, reverse shot. There's also not a lot of wide shots in this movie. Even though baseball is a big game, there's a massive stadium, there's all this. And I get if they wanted to go with a more grounded point of view, but there are one or two shots in this that are wide. Like, we see Brad Pitt in his car all the time, and there's literally just that one shot of that side angle of him staring in his car. They can't be bothered to do a 45 degree angle looking through his car window, for example, where we can see more of his face. But there is one shot where he decides the Oakland A's are on their winning streak. I think they're on game 7 or 8. And he turns on the news, hears the radio, and then decides, you know what? I'm going to go back and watch my boys.
No, this is as they're about to break. This is in my opinion, the highest point of the movie. This is whenever they're about to break an American League record and get a 20-game win streak.
The 20-game. Yeah. Okay, yeah. Yeah, yeah. It's right around there where he swerves around and it cuts to a shot of his car, his pickup truck, which we've never seen in full, really, swerve and go off the exit. And that's really one of the fewest wide shots I can think of.
Beginning is a wide shot. The very beginning where he's sitting alone in the stadium is also wide.
It's a wide shot. It's just an extremely wide shot. And the background's out of focus.
Yeah.
We don't get a sense of space. We get a sense of character. And for a character study, for a lot of dialogue in this movie, that's not necessarily a bad thing. But there doesn't seem to be a deliberateness with it. Even the lighting is okay. But it's very paint by numbers. It's like, oh, here's the daylight. Oh, they're in the fluorescent building. Oh, they're in the parking garage. Oh, he's in his car. There's nothing that sticks out in terms of craft or creativity. It's just we're filming people.
I'm going to tell you two things that I really appreciated about this movie technically.
Talk to me.
Just to sort of, as you're laying them down, I'm trying to bring them up a little bit.
Okay. Okay. Good cop, bad cop.
Yeah, there were two things that I appreciated. One being a similar lighting setup and camera angle that they kept returning to that brought about a sense of familiar sullenness and heartbreak. I think was maybe the shot that you were talking about where it just keeps coming back to Brad Pitt's face and he's just completely zoned out listening to this game, trying not to like flip his lid, basically.
Yeah.
It's the face that he makes in the very first shot of his, like the very first close-up. It's a face that we see as the win is being thrown away for a potential 20-win streak. It's the face that's made whenever they lose the World Series. That's one thing that I really appreciated was there's a sense of familiar sadness in this character that I'm gathering from this return, this shot that we're returning to. I agree there's so much creativity that could have been that wasn't there, but there is one creative thing that I want to highlight.
That's right.
We don't see the players on the field. We don't see plays being made on the field at all, except for one moment. Whenever Brad Pitt's character doesn't attend the baseball games, we see small snippets from the archives of the real, like, televised version of the game, and we hear snippets on the radio. But whenever Brad Pitt comes in person, we actually see the actors on the field hitting the ball, pitching the ball, fielding the ball. And that really felt big to me.
Yeah.
I really appreciated how they said, we're going to be so limited in our perspective that we're just going to show you small, like, condensed bits of the game because the main character is not there. But whenever he does show up there, the game is practically larger than life. The lighting's dramatic. The contrast is crazy. That's something I love.
That is a good point. I will say they do show a close up at one point several of Philip Seymour Hoffman's character just because he's the coach. But even when he's on television, there are a few shots where they show close ups of his face. However, what I thought you were going to say is now that I think about it, we never really see. One of the biggest tensions in the movie is between Art Howe, the coach, and Billy Bean. And the one time we see Art actually make a decision is when he finally puts the right guy out there on the field, the way Billy Bean would want to play. He puts Chris Pratt's character, Hattenberg, out in the field. And that's the only time we see him actually make a play that I can recall that's actually in the movie, that we're actually boots on the ground, we're in the dugout. And so it really highlights that pivotal moment, the moment that you want to actually record and have actors for. And there's a lot there. So there is creativity in this movie. There's just not, it feels at worst lazy and at best complacent.
Those are the moments that I appreciated cinematography wise. Usually with other movies, it's like, I can't even begin to start listing and describing.
Yeah.
But I remembered this moment so distinctly because the rest, like you said, was shot, reverse shot, shot, reverse shot, reverse shot.
Yeah. And whenever they get technical, they just show a bunch of miscellaneous shots of numbers. I don't have any connection to those numbers. It's just a bunch of, I feel, filibuster that says, ooh, numbers I don't understand. They must be really smart. Look at those squared numbers and numbers on top of other numbers and root signs. And, oh man, this must be big brain time. And then they show numbers and then they show archive footage of players and they freeze in time the recordings of the players. And they talk and they show numbers and it feels unpurposeful. It doesn't feel like there's a lot of deliberateness in this movie. There is deliberateness, but there's not a lot of it. Even in the story, this is one of my biggest gripes with Billy Bean. He has character development, but it's not what I would consider a character arc. If anything, I would call it a character cliff, where the beginning of the movie, actually, you know, I take that back. We don't learn about the problems he has as a general manager until in the middle of the movie, where he says he doesn't consort with other players. He has Pete Brand go with the other players, even though and then Pete says, why don't you go? And he says, I deliberately just, you know, keep them at a distance. And then Pete, while he's on the trip, he's talking to David Justice, who mentions, like, why does soda cost $1? And all that, and Pete doesn't have an answer. Pete never relays any of this information to Billy Bean, and then randomly towards the end of the movie, Billy Bean suddenly, while he's negotiating, he also says, hey, and also make the soda cheaper. Can't have them spending $1 for it. And Pete Brand seems to be happy about that. But then I feel like that
moment did happen.
Did it?
I feel like he did say something offhanded about soda costing $1. I don't know. Maybe I imagined that happening.
I don't know. I don't remember it happening. I just remember all of a sudden Billy Bean goes from this cold, distant anger management issue guy who eats a lot of food.
No, he doesn't eat a lot of food. He chews a lot of tobacco and it's disgusting.
No, it's food. There's sunflower seeds. There's popcorn. There might be tobacco. There's definitely a burrito at least once. There's sandwiches. Like, there's a lot of different stuff he shoves into his mouth. Oh, yeah.
I really thought it was all just chewing tobacco.
No.
He's keeping in his lip.
Oh, it's food. I don't know why, Typically in movies, when your character eats something or chews in front of other people, it's because they're a jerk. Maybe mm-hmm. that's one of the reasons I don't like Billy Bean. But we go from this cold-hearted guy to suddenly he's in the locker rooms, he's pulling players aside, talking to them, bringing them into his brain, basically, talking strategy. And I'm thinking, how did we get here? When was the moment where he made a choice to do that? The closest thing to that moment I can think of is he's driving in circles around in his pickup, and then he stops himself in the middle of the night. He's in his truck, and he just thinks. And then he says, yeah. And then boom. So was that his character moment? Was that the moment he decided he needed to change his life? Because if so, pretty lazy, would have liked there to be some dialogue banter and an actual choice made.
To me, the moment is in the office with Peter whenever he's making all these phone calls to other agents. He's getting rid of, what were the players' names?
I can't remember.
He was getting rid of Jeremy Giambi. He was getting rid of Pena. He was getting rid of these big all-star characters that we were holding on to, these big all-star players, because we were holding on to that old world. But whenever he gets rid of them and he finagles things to where he can play Moneyball his way,
yeah,
that's whenever he really doubles down. And that's whenever the change starts to happen, because he finally starts to take ownership of the team, because everyone that's there is there because he wants them to be there.
Hmm.
I feel like that scene pretty concisely shows, like, when he's pivoting. Even Peter is like, whoa, like, he's basically saying to the listeners, like the viewers, hey, the main character is going into the point of no return now.
Sure.
Are you sure you want to do that main character? So, like, yeah. it's very much played out, and I can definitely see where that decision happens.
And to an extent, I appreciate the fact that it's that subdued, if that is true. However, I remember that exact same scene in the very beginning. He stares Peter Brand directly in the eyes and says, do you think this works? Do you believe in this? And I'm thinking, buddy, we're in the third act now. You've already asked this question, I feel. You've already asked this question. Remember a similar scene where he starts threatening Peter Brand and starts getting rid of players, and Peter Brand says, what are you doing? What are you doing?
That's the scene I'm talking about.
Really? I thought you were talking about the scene that came way after that, where he starts bringing on people to play Moneyball. There's a scene in the beginning of the movie where he pulls Peter Brand in, and Peter Brand goes, what are you doing? And he starts just getting rid of people.
Dude, I don't know.
See, these scenes are so not different visually. Even the flashbacks, they don't use the typical sepia tone. It's just the live action color grade. And I go, what? Yeah. Okay, here's another thing. Never thought I'd rant about this in a movie. The title graphics. Pick a lane, people. Are you going to show the date and then the location they're playing? Are you going to flash the player's name right next to them in a lower third as they walk across so we don't lose track of every single face and then not do it the entire movie? Are you going to start showing the place and the date randomly in the middle of the movie and not keep that consistent across the board? Do you not trust us to figure it out? Or are you so insecure about the way the visuals were done to the point where you go, I guess we'll throw a lot of information out there? Are you going to try and, what, spell out the ending for us? Tell us how everyone lives, dies, gets married, and divorces all in the ending text? Are we going to end on a note of, yeah, Billy Bean still hasn't won a World Series? Because that sucks. I'm sorry. As a storyteller, you control information. So control it, but be consistent. Gosh dang it.
Are we trying to make Billy Bean a winner, or are we trying to make Billy Bean a martyr? Because I feel like confidence is a very strong theme in this movie, and I wanted to see Billy Bean's confidence be raised by the things that happened. And I feel like the quote-unquote completion of his quote-unquote arc was him turning down the Boston Red Sox position.
That's true.
Can we talk about, is it okay if we just start talking about the ending?
Let's just talk about it.
Because I feel like I don't have much else to say but the ending
here. Yeah, go for it.
Because it really.
Talk to me.
So he turns down the Boston Red Sox job, the highest paying managerial position in the history of baseball. He turns it down because he wants to win with the A's. He wants to prove that he doesn't have to win with big money. And that's what he does. And his relationship with his daughter is preserved because he's staying in Oakland. And he is he's continuing with the A's, and we see him go out onto the field and spend time with players and enjoy more quality time with his daughter. He and Peter get closer, and then we just start to see the next season take off, and that's how it ends. Just kidding. Half of that didn't happen because we just got a block of text.
Yeah. He didn't actually accept the contract. It's like, I don't know. It's like watching Star Wars Empire Strikes Back, and Luke's about to show down with Darth Vader, and it ends on a cliffhanger. And then a block of text appears said, Luke fought Darth Vader, and Darth Vader told him he was his father. The end. Directed by George Lucas.
Not even that. Darth Vader killed Luke Skywalker. That's what it would say in text, because at the end, the hero does not succeed. Is he a martyr? Is this
Luke Skywalker died?
This based on a true story. Okay, so we have to keep the facts straight.
Yeah.
But how can we spin this in a way that doesn't feel like a huge bummer at the end?
Yeah.
Because he did change baseball for the greater good, but can you show us that instead of telling it?
Right.
Because I feel like showing us would make it feel a lot better than just telling us with a block of text.
What makes it jarring as well is the ending before the block of text is we have some setup of he has to make a big choice. The note that was ended on, the vibe I got, maybe I'm a smooth brain, James, because you clearly pick up on more subtlety in these things than I do. But when he's talking to Peter Brand, they have that one-on-one. Peter Brand shows him the guy who, you know, is scared to go to second base. He decides to do it. He screws up, but it turns out he actually won a home run. So the vibe I got was, hey, you won big, even though you think you didn't. And there's this optimism of, we're thinking ahead about the future. We're thinking about the game. And we're thinking that, yeah, it was worth it. Billy Beane did succeed. And then we end on the note that the aftertaste is pretty good. And if they had honestly eliminated the block of text, I would have been okay not knowing how the rest of it played out. I think it's okay to leave the ending ambiguous with this type of film. But instead they go, yeah, he didn't succeed. He failed.
He's still trying to get a win out of the Oakland A's. And guess what? Boston went on and won without him using his same strategy.
Yeah.
Loser.
Yeah, it's like, okay, I could have gotten depressed if I researched further after this movie, but you don't have to. Movies that are based on real life are based on real life. There's a reason why filmmakers will add fictitious elements, because at the end of the day, if I were to do an ultra-faithful adaptation of, say, James's life, no offense, James, most of it would be boring. James brushes his teeth. James is sleeping in bed. James had a dream that doesn't mean anything about the narrative, but it was a dream he had in that moment, so I have to tell it exactly as
Daniel,
it was.
Daniel, it's crazy. I had a dream that there was this vitamin supplement that everyone ate, and it turned them into werefoxes. Not werewolves, werefoxes. And the I tried to warn everybody, the vitamin supplement was not FDA approved, but they did it anyway, and my wife turned into a werefox instead of a werewolf, and she tried to kill me.
James would later die 2 days later after having the dream due to complications from acute arthritis.
His carpals exploded and he died from drawing too much.
James is one of the few people to have perished from spontaneous combustion.
That is how it feels, though. That's how the ending of Moneyball feels.
It's like if Chad Movie Ruiner just interrupted the film and said, yeah, don't get too attached. He totally doesn't even get what he wants at the end in real life. It's like a person that loves Billy Beane and has read his book and like knows everything about him. And then you walk out of the movie and go, you know what? That wasn't a bad movie. And then they go, yeah, but he's never won. You know that, right? He's still trying to get in the World Series. You know that, right? And you're like, shut up. Just let me enjoy this for once. But they add that in the movie.
Yes. And there's this sad cop-out where it's like, yeah, but it's not all about winning. I feel like they try to push that in the last 10 minutes. Like, hey, it's not all about winning. And they do it well at first by saying, you know, like what you said, showing him that clip of the guy that actually got the home run was afraid to leave first.
Yeah.
That was good. But then they continue to push it. And with the song at the end, just talking about like, hey, man, like Life is confusing, but just enjoy it, you know? Yeah. Stop being such a loser.
What's weird for me, and I feel so cold-hearted as a critic to say this, but as I was listening to his daughter's song, it just wasn't endearing to me because I thought, this is actually pretty good for a girl her age, and it's very well mixed. There's no way she would do that well. And let's say there is a way because her dad is the general manager of the Oakland A's. Okay, if that's the case, then she has access to incredibly good recording equipment and a sound engineer that can make her sound a little bit more dialed in and polished. It just
sounded
too good.
I wonder if this might be a bit of a nitpick. I don't know. Maybe just a little bit.
Oh, it's definitely a nitpick. I was like, there's no way. There's no way she's that skilled. Now, if his daughter was in her early 20s, maybe. Maybe if music was her passion. Maybe if they're walking around the guitar store, she says, oh, those are Fenders, Dad. You know, I just don't like the way they sound, but I'm more of a fan of this guitar over here. And she kind of picks it up. I'm not pitching that she should be scaled up in age. I don't know. I just... this just isn't... How do I say this? This is a... I have a hard time deciding if a sports fan made this movie or if this movie director tried to make this more appeasing to sports fans and in the process lost a lot of the craft of storytelling. I don't know.
I don't know.
I don't know if a baseball buff decided to make a big budget movie with a ton of high name actors. But
because if you like sports, I'm going to say that you should go check out this movie because it's pretty interesting conceptually.
I don't.
And if you lived through this history of baseball, it's got to be interesting to see this perspective.
James, I would take if you're listening to this and you say it sounds like Daniel and James are fighting, let me add you some clarity, dear listener. Listen to what James is saying. Unlike James, I did not grow up in the world of sports. I am a Chicagoan, born and raised. I don't live in Chicago anymore, but, you know, whenever our teams were doing good, I'd get on board that hype train. I was a hype rider, okay? I rode the hype train. I'm not ashamed to admit that. But my parents were indifferent about sports. My brother likes sports, but he's not ride or die. And so... I can't really speak to what a sports fan would like. So take what I say with a grain of salt. Take what James says more seriously. That's my guidance. And hopefully that gives you some clarity.
And I currently am not a crazy sports fan. I just grew up on it. I like playing baseball. I liked watching baseball with my dad. I liked watching football, all that stuff.
Yeah.
I'm not a huge sports guy. If you've been listening to this podcast from the beginning and you haven't gathered that already, I am shocked. But I want to heel turn. My last thing that I wanted to talk about was the amount of pieces left behind that did not come to fruition. We already talked about Billy Bean's character and the lessons he didn't learn.
Yeah.
I guess he still thinks he's a curse, probably. We never really were reinforced that, like, it doesn't matter if you come or go to the games. They're going to do fine or they're going to do bad either way.
Right. It would have been nice to see an actual acted out movie scene or two or three where we see Billy Bean as he's older watching the Red Sox win on his, you know, reasoning and logic. I did some research. Billy Bean did not win for a long time. I think he finally won, I think, the American West League. I could be wrong. Apparently, after this movie came out, after a lot of other people adopted the Moneyball technique, Billy Bean actually realized that one part of Moneyball that undervalued defense in a team. So when he started ironing that out, his team actually did really, really, really well. Again, they always have, but they did really well in defense. And I think he actually won not the World Series, but another thing. So.
If you win the American League, then that means you're moving on to the World Series.
Okay. So.
So.
Great.
He kind of just did the thing that he did in the movie twice already.
Yeah.
But.
Yeah.
But good on him. I hope he's living a long and happy life. Billy Bean, if you're listening to this podcast, God bless you, but you're going to get mouth cancer. Please stop chewing tobacco. It's disgusting.
Billy Bean, if you're listening to this, please plug our podcast.
How much pull do you think Billy Bean has, Daniel?
I don't know. I don't know.
How many Twitter followers do you think Billy Bean has?
But hey, if this is, you know, Jack had his Beanstalk, then Casually Critical has their Billy Beanstalk.
Ah! Okay, first good pun of the episode, Daniel. I'll give you that one.
But that's actually saying a lot. Yeah, thank you.
So I wanted to loop back. There are a couple characters that we know nothing about.
Yeah.
We know nothing about Peter Brand. Who is Peter Brand? What's he about outside of this job? We know nothing.
True.
Who is Scott Hatteberg? We get a small glimpse into him really counting on a job and being out of the job. And then Billy Bean comes around and says, hey, even though your arm's busted, you are worth something to
right.
me.
Right. They put a lot
That's
of undue.
Stuff that I...
They put a lot of undue emphasis on Hattenberg. Like, it's fun to see Chris Pratt in a very kind of quiet role where he's not front
and
center.
Yeah, he does well.
Yeah, he does really well. We see his wife, his kids. We get a somewhat humorous moment where his kids kind of interrupt his talk with Billy Bean almost. And some humorous back and forth between Billy Bean and I think Ron Washington, where Ron Washington's like, it's terrible. You'll be terrible at it. I don't know. It's funny.
Yeah.
But
it's the hardest thing you'll ever do, right. learning how to play first base. And Billy Bean's like, it's easy.
But like, okay, I was like, okay, so Hedberg gets his own scene with his family and like dialogue. The other guys just get Billy Bean asking them, you know, to recruiting them. So I thought he'd have a bigger role to play. And the only biggest role he plays is he hits the ball.
Yep.
Great. Why did we spend that much time? Aaron? You and your co-writer could have pared this down. I don't.
No, I mean, I don't think they should have. I think they should have fleshed him out more. And I think we
That's
should
what
have
I'm
fleshed
saying.
Out Peter a
Look,
little bit more.
Either man up and flesh this guy out or cut his scene, because why do we spend so much time with a guy who hits the ball and we see briefly throughout the rest of the movie? That's what I'm saying. There needs to be a purpose.
Going back to what you said about Billy's wife, Sharon.
Robin White's like,
why is she here?
Robin Wright showed up and said, hey, I know you're making a movie about Billy Bean's book, Moneyball. Or it wasn't Billy Bean. It was based on Billy Bean. That person's book about Moneyball. I want a paycheck. And they say,
what can she do?
You can play Chris Pratt's wife. And she's like, no, I want to play Brad Pitt's wife for clout with my celebrity friends. And they go, fine.
Fine. She doesn't make an appearance in our script, and she's like, make an appearance and give me a really shrimpy ex-husband or a really shrimpy current husband that I used to replace Billy.
They're like,
fine. Okay,
we have the daughter character, so we'll just, you know, move her over.
The writers start rubbing their hands together. They're like, ooh, this is great. Now we can show off how gritty Billy Bean is in contrast to this normie who married his ex-wife.
Yeah.
And that's it.
Yeah.
That's the whole function of that 5-minute scene.
Yeah. And then also the tension between Billy Bean and Art Howe, I never feel gets resolved in a meaningful way between the two of them. I was talking about that scene where Art finally plays Hattenberg.
The only reason he plays Hattenberg is because Pena gets fired.
Right. They put him in a stranglehold. And it's resolved with resignation. There's no face to face. And it feels incredibly anticlimactic. Also, they do put a ticking time bomb in the story of he has a 1-year contract and he keeps mentioning that. That gets reinforced. And then they just kind of drop it. They say, oh, we got a lot of other things to juggle, like spoiling the fact that Billy Bean's a disappointment.
The 1-year contract serves the function of like establishing that Art Howe is unhappy with his job and doesn't feel secure. And he feels like he's a like just some commodity you can tote around and then throw away.
But, and then he is toted around.
And then his ideals are thrown away.
Yeah.
So like,
Billy Bean takes his middle finger and shoves it deep up of Art Howe's rectum. And Art Howe does nothing. I'm sorry.
Whoa.
I said the R word.
Sorry. Kids at home. Kids at home. Retroactively, don't listen to that. That was disgusting.
I'm sorry. Up his derriere.
It's
vertically into
it's
his
gross.
Posterior.
Nope, still gross. Doesn't matter the concept. Conceptually, I still have the same image in my head, and I don't want it. So yeah, we've got every character besides Billy Bean not fleshed out. But then Billy Bean doesn't even have a concise character arc.
Right.
That's all I was trying to say, really. and give a few evidential examples.
Mm.
So,
guys, we're Daniel and James, and you've been listening to our podcast, Casually Critical. Daniel and James never reviewed Moneyball ever again. Daniel had a big falling out with James, in which they never talked to each other for 4 years. They still don't talk to this day.